prevent its disappearance. The following chapters will delve deeper into what we explored in the previous chapters. Besides looking at the media of the age, books, sculpture, painting, graphics, photographs, technical objects, lists, and pedigree records, we will explore the places and institutions, the stud farm, racecourse, clinic, artist's studio, and publishing house, the social communities, farmers, handlers, anatomists, blacksmiths, militarymen, researchers, authors, and con men, and finally, the knowledge-related practices, selection, breeding, medical care, training, collecting, anatomy, drawing, and taxidermy. Every artifact of horse history, seen in this light, contains a narrative of migrating knowledge. Each carriage tells of the landscape it was originally associated with, of the craftsmen who for generations had harnessed knowledge of different woods and metals, of the quality of draft animals and the challenges of the roads, of traders who took into account their customers' ever-changing tastes. Every saddle speaks of riding positions and postures, of social hierarchies and codes of power, of hunting techniques and the tactics of war. Like Tolstoy's Klostermer, the story of a horse, every animal tells the tale of its birth and happy youth, the distinction of its stables and the social classes it has passed through, of the misfortunes it has survived and the plight of old age. Every whip tells the story of pain endured, every sword the vicissitudes of a military campaign, every stirrup the epic rise and fall of the feudal world. On these migratory trails of knowledge, occasionally it is historical accident that seizes the reins, prompting the formation of allegorical constellations. After the death of the painter Peter Paul Rubens in 1640, for example, an exiled English general rented his residence in Antwerp. It was here that William Cavendish, Earl and later Duke of Newcastle, a supporter of the defeated royalists in the Civil War, pursued his passion for breeding and training horses. In the grounds where, until recently, Rubens had created his masterpieces, Cavendish now set up a riding academy, where he developed his new English school of dressage, which quickly made him famous throughout Europe and helped sales of his work on horsemanship. La méthode et invention nouvelle de dresser les chevaux, first published in French in 1657. It would run to 10 editions in English, French, and German over the next 100 years, a success which owed some debt to the dynamic illustrations by Abraham van Diepenbeeck, a former pupil of Rubens. At first glance, the transformation of Rubens's former home and studio into Cavendish's riding school may seem like a profanity, whereas in fact, it was simply one Baroque art form being replaced by another, a ballet danced by beautiful horses. Blood and Speed. Fall from the Carousel. In the late 19th century, between 1896 and 1898, Edward Degas was working on a painting which represented an unusual departure from his previous work, Plate 11. Its subject is a riding accident. A fallen rider lies on his back on the grass, while a horse, possibly his, gallops past or jumps over him. 4/5 of the canvas is filled with green grass. 1/5 is sky. Beyond that, there is nothing to see. No excited audience. No panicked running about. No furious gestures. The picture is strangely still and quiet in comparison with the dramatic events it portrays. The title is Jockey Blessé, The Injured Jockey. But there is nothing to see that indicates an injury. The rider's right leg seems to have slipped out of his boot, but the left leg is bent and could suggest a fracture. But it is not obvious. It is the flat, immobile position of the man which does not bode well. The injured jockey could be dying, or indeed already dead. The horse, a bay thoroughbred, whose head shape betrays its Arabian extraction, thunders past, empty saddle on its back, front and hind legs outstretched like a wooden horse on a fairground carousel, tail flowing behind, and mane braids standing on end. All these movements seem frozen in time, captured quickly with a high shutter speed. The painter makes no attempt to make the scene dynamic. The viewer is not given any explanation of the causality nor any narrative complement that might hint at the before and after. If we want to find out what is concealed within the taciturn image, there are three different archives we might consult: the painter's records, those of the events of the time, and the iconographic context. In the first of the three, we find an early horse racing tableau by the painter, a Sin du Steeplechase, whose subtitle is The Fallen Jockey. Degas submitted the painting to the Salon of 1866. It shows a racing accident, a fallen jockey who is lying on the ground, with a riderless horse passing by, while two other jockeys ride by unmoved. 30 years later, the mature Degas takes up the scene again, reducing the formula to the fallen man and the riderless horse. Plate 11. Accidents on the racetrack are not uncommon, and if, like Degas, you spent days and weeks at the track, you've got a good chance of witnessing such an event. With the help of the newspapers of the time, the archive of the events, it would be possible, with some meticulous research, to track down the details of the accident the painter observed, whether the horse bolted, who the injured jockey was, and what became of him. It becomes more complicated in the third dimension, the archive of iconography. The title seems to allude to a picture by Géricault from 1814, a good 70 years earlier, which at the time was assumed to refer to the defeat of the French armies in the Campagne de France. But the cuirassier blessé, Quittant le Fou, who also has no visible external injury, has very little in common with Degas' injured jockey, except for his diagonal orientation across the composition of the picture, unless we wish to see in the boots of the jockey, his bright trousers, and his bulky, cuirass-like jersey, an allusion to the uniform of the cavalry. Despite his invisible injury, Géricault's cavalryman remains a son of Mars, summoning his remaining strength to rein in his horse's impetuosity, while Degas' jockey resembles a carelessly knocked-over chess piece or an abandoned toy lying wearily on the ground. And while Géricault's hero still grips his weapon in hand, Degas' jockey is stripped of all accessories. There's not even a lost whip to be seen. However, there is one more card we can draw from the archives, and that's the image of possibly the most prominent victim of a horse-related accident: Saul on the road to Damascus, who was resurrected as Paul the Apostle as a result of his fall. Let us consider the perspective that Parmigianino put the event in the conversion of Saul. Again, we see the fallen rider, albeit uninjured, in front of or beneath the horse, which rises up over him, still wearing the bridle. But the tone of the horse, the majestic white, the color of the light that breaks through the clouds behind him, the ermine blanket, and beneath it the noble animal form with the full-bodied rump, suggesting an official rather than sporting function, but especially his stance, rearing up in the levade, all this locates the horse within the Occidental iconography of sovereignty. Like Saul, the fallen nobleman, the Roman knight, whose sword lies beneath his leg, the horse at this moment undergoes a resurrection as the docile mount of a Miles Christianus, a Christian soldier. It is not a fall that Parmigianino depicts, but rather a new spiritual elevation. Degas' injured jockey is no fallen Saul on the road to Damascus. The jockey lies between the legs of his horse as though within the brackets of a mathematical equation. Degas painted a green chalkboard on which he wrote the equation of modern racing. In front of the brackets is speed, and within the brackets are beauty and death. Everyone imagines that they know where Degas most loved to spend his time, where he drew his inspiration, and where he encountered the personalities that emerged as ideas and colors in his paintings and pastels, in the ballet studio. Nobody thinks of the race course, and yet Degas admired the flanks of the racehorses and the jockeys' colorful jerseys almost as much as the slender legs of the dancers and their rosy tutus. He was as thrilled by thoroughbred racing in Boulogne as by the contretemps and glissades of the slender ballerinas. The dance hall and the race course both provided his muse. Had he lived 2 centuries earlier, a subject of the Sun King, and not a citizen of the Third Republic, he would have been able to indulge both pleasures at the same location, in the 17th and well into the 18th century, the dance hall and indoor riding arena were largely identical. The famous riding teachers, from Antoine de Pluvinel, 1623, to François de la Guinière, 1733, taught riding, or rather, the exemplary movement of rider and horse, as an advanced form of court dance, where the aim was to replicate the elegance and grace of the dancers. The most important dance step of the unequal pair was the levade, where the horse rests its weight on its hind legs, while the rider sits perpendicular to the ground, forming a softly and gently closing cross with the horse's body. Together, rider and horse adopted the classic pose of sovereignty, an age-old obsession of painters and sculptors, and an integral part of the Western repertoire of the iconography of secular rule. During the 18th century, the schools of dance and riding would go their separate ways. The riding school came into the hands of the military before it became the domain of racing trainers. It was only on the ballet stage that the Ancien Régime lived on with its strict forms, the ritual of pirouettes, leaps and airs above the ground, and the poised geometry of bodies hovering beyond gravity. As at the ballet, from which it had been separated for more than a century, the racecourse of the fin de siècle also conveyed the notion of a possible and sometimes tangible victory over gravity. The speed of the animals and the low weight of their riders produced the impression of levitation without the levade. The appearance was no longer of a bird in flight, but of an arrow zipping from the bowstring. At the moment of a fall, the two bodies, combined as one vector during flight, are broken up into their constituent parts, and gravity, momentarily overcome, now reels those parts back in. This is the moment that Degas captures in his painting. Perhaps this is his real subject. The jockey does not lie on the ground, but appears to levitate, frozen in the falling motion, an endless freefall propelled by his returning weight, while the horse galloping on without its rider continues to convey the sense of weightlessness. Born under a solar eclipse. The history of English horse racing is, like the rise of the Suffolk market town of Newmarket, closely linked to the rule of the Stuarts. As in other European countries, we might think of the Palio of Siena. There had been horse racing in England before the 17th century, run at a local level or organized by individual members of the landed gentry. But with Newmarket and the Stuarts, a new dynamic came into play. The first race in this still relatively insignificant location took place in 1622. James I of England, son of Mary, Queen of Scots, had discovered the small village in 1605, identifying its broad heath as the perfect ground for racing. Over the next few years, he developed it into his personal estate for hunting and sport. Under his son, Charles I, the sleepy hamlet was promoted to a kind of second capital of the kingdom, where from 1627, regular spring and autumn races took place. However, the crucial phase of racing as a sport funded and promoted by kings only really began in 1660. When, after years of the Puritan Republic, which took a hostile attitude to sport, the monarchy was restored, and Charles II returned from French exile. In 1671, King Charles II, a great lover of speed, himself won the race for the town plate, which he had established 5 years previously. In the same year, the world's first training stable was established at Palace House. The years after his death, 1685, saw the rise of English racehorse breeding, where the three famous Arabian Foundation stallions played their role in founding a dynasty. Bialy Turk, imported in 1687, Darley Arabian, 1704, and Godolphin Arabian, 1729, became the founders of the three main lines of Arab blood in English breeding. Thoroughbreds, or blood horses, were the offspring of the deliberate combination of the Oriental and English lines, the hot-blooded horses, whose proven quality on the racetrack was much sought after. The close association of the English monarchy with breeding and racing did not end with the Stuarts. As historical accident would have it, the news of the death of Queen Anne in August 1714 spread just as the country's nobility were congregated at York Racecourse. It was at this very location that a decision was taken for the crown to be passed to the Hanoverians. The monarchs who came to the throne as a result of this decision, from George I onwards to Queen Victoria, carried on the country's hippophile and racetrack traditions with vigor, making England the world power of thoroughbred racing. When Daniel Defoe travelled through the British Isles in 1720, he saw in Newmarket an established racing industry and a great concourse of the nobility and gentry, as well from London as from all parts of England. According to official statements, when Oriental horses were imported, initially individual stallions but later also groups of mares, such as the royal mares in the first decades of the 17th century, to be crossed with examples of indigenous breeds, it was with the intention of improving the genetic characteristics of native horse breeds in general. In fact, it was primarily about speed. The aim of breeding was a fast horse, one that won races. It was not only a certain landowning and animal breeding section of the English nobility that identified with this goal. It was a project that had the backing of the English crown. From the 17th century, the English monarchy was a kingdom of speed. The appeal of horse racing, writes a historian of our day, lay not only in the fact that nowhere else were such high speeds achieved, but also in its symbolic value as the sport of kings. English monarchs raced, occasionally winning, and in the records of the racing calendars which appeared regularly from 1727, they were listed as racehorse stable proprietors, horse owners, breeders, and employers of jockeys. They also belonged to the Jockey Club, founded in 1750, in London initially, but based since 1752 at Newmarket. The club, founded to organize races and regulate betting debts among its members, also gained in authority as it undertook to establish rules for competitions and to implement them nationwide. Started by the royal family, its membership included broad swathes of the nobility and went through a process of secularization and bourgeoisification, though this was not recognized by its members. The Jockey Club, writes historian Otto Brunner, was not only an organizer of events, it was also the social hub of the nobility. Its members did not appear to be aware of the extent to which they were functioning in a typically bourgeois social structure. Procuring Arabian horses, or rather Oriental breeds, which also included Turks and Berbers, was no easy matter in the 17th and well into the 18th century. On the contrary, it was a costly and time-consuming, not to mention dangerous, enterprise. The prestige that the possession of such horses brought with it, and which could be further increased by success in racing and breeding, also came at a social price. The nobility saw itself as reliant on a class of indispensable professionals, buyers, trainers, jockeys, handlers, and grooms, mostly recruited from the rural population, and who advised them and supported them in many ways. Besides the civil service, diplomatic service, the military, and the law, a new modern type of professional expert now emerged on the stud farm and racetrack. At the same time, an unexpected rival to the nobility arose in the competition for social glitz, fame, and survival in the memory of posterity. This rival took the form of the celebrity racehorse, whose name as a race winner, or sire, or mare, was recorded in the annals of the racing calendar and stud books. In fact, 18th century England experienced a second birth of the celebrity cult. Alongside the famous painters from Rubens to Reynolds, and the acclaimed actor David Garrick, there was the celebrated racehorse Eclipse, 1764 to 1789, born during the solar eclipse in the year 1764, and undefeated in all his races. His offspring won more than 850 races, and his skeleton can be seen to this day in the National Horse Racing Museum in Newmarket. Sport and suspense. If we are to describe the route to the leisure class, which the hereditary nobility shared with representatives of the moneyed aristocracy and the bourgeoisie, we should not overlook the third economic aspect of the racehorse alongside the auction of thoroughbreds and the prize money from the race. That third pillar is betting. Since the early modern period, the betting industry had been a shadow that followed every kind of sport that the nobility showed an interest in, above all, horse racing. The high stakes that were placed at the racecourse were another aspect of conspicuous consumption, as described by Thorstein Veblen. Horse racing and betting grew up side by side, carrying each other along, while Britain's more open social structure, compared to the continent, played a major role. Since the racecourses were opened up to the middle and lower classes, betting even allowed spectators who could not have their own horse to participate in the gentleman's sport. One commentator towards the end of the 19th century described the betting trade as a fertilizer, which promoted the staggering growth of horse racing and racehorse breeding. Moreover, betting on horses, as Max Weber has suggested, was no game of chance like roulette. It was a thrill with a significantly higher proportion of rationality. A wager on English sports was seen as one where you could make an informed and reasoned judgment about the probability of the outcome. You had to weigh up the previous successes of the horses at the starting line against certain other factors: their weight, the jockey's experience, the length and nature of the track. A calculated bet based on these factors and discounting uncertainties, a fall, lameness, etc., was comparable to a capital investment, which was never completely without risk. As a rational business, the sporting bets with the stock exchange and other speculative transactions. Again and again, cultural anthropologists and sociologists have pointed out that betting on sporting events came to replace the bloody battles and games of earlier times, making sport compatible with the civil codes of modern working life. The horse race, the most sublime form of agon involving animals, combined with a speculative financial profit, gave Fortuna her contemporary face. During the 17th century in England, the deer hunt gave way to fox hunting as a major aristocratic pursuit. The element of physical force, even cruelty, which was clearly present in deer hunting and which was captured in courtly painting, remained with fox hunting, but was pushed to the background vis-à-vis the pleasure in the duration and speed of the hunt. The agile, persistent, and cunning fox was considered a guaranteed good sport. Strict rules for hunters and hounds and self-imposed restrictions allowed new goals to be isolated. The beautiful race, the suspense, the excitement. This process of sublimation reached its civilizing ideal form and its historical endpoint in horse racing. The element of physical force is completely eliminated and replaced with the abstract form of pure speed. In greyhound racing, the pack rushes after the skin of a hare. In horse racing, nothing and no one is hunted, only the shadows of time. In the century between the death of Charles II in 1685 and the establishment of five classic races in England, from the St. Leger to the Derby in around 1780, the monarchy underwent a curious and momentous shift in coordinates from the vertical axis of transcendental sovereignty to the horizontal axis of pure speed. In the new poetics of the racetrack, an art form indifferent to class distinctions, there emerged an alliance of beauty, speed, and danger. The bright colors, stripes, and checks on the jockeys' jerseys and caps, a system introduced by the Jockey Club, represented a return of heraldry as a semiotic construct for identifying the otherwise indiscernible participants. Whereas in the medieval tournament, the colors, patterns, and animal imagery of the coat of arms made it possible to distinguish who was hiding beneath the armor and helmet, so the modern heraldry of the racecourse made it possible to identify the riders blurred by the speed of their motion. The English Puritans did not look kindly on horse racing, as was the case with all sports associated with betting. That did not, of course, prevent their simultaneous, decisive contribution to the renewal of the cavalry in early modern Europe. Oliver Cromwell, who did not attain the rank of Lieutenant General of Horse until the age of 43, but was nevertheless considered the best rider in England, was the most fervent supporter, after Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden, of the cavalry as an offensive tool of war. In fact, a comparative study of the use of horses in war and sport since the Renaissance could unearth some surprising parallels. The increase in agility and discipline of cavalry formations, the lightness and speed of the horses, the growing number of cavalrymen, their differentiation as cuirassiers, dragoons, hussars, uhlans, etc., and their tactical use as an offensive weapon corresponds with the promotion and regulation of horse racing, breeding, and betting by the restored English Crown and, from 1750, the Jockey Club. The club is, in a way, the civilian general staff for the light cavalry of the racehorse. However, the development of the racing and breeding of racing-fit thoroughbreds ran on separate tracks to the development of the modern cavalry. Despite all the functional overlaps, the appreciation of the fast and relatively resilient thoroughbreds, the absolute importance of speed on the racetrack, and its relative significance on the battlefield, improvements to training, the codification of practical knowledge, and despite all the personal connections, the racehorse and the battlefield remained systematically distinct. Horse racing might be a serious game, but unlike a military battle, it is not decided by blood, at least not that of the rider, usually. Even if it ignored this fundamental difference, the narrative superimposition of a horse race and a cavalry attack, which Claude Simon achieves in The Flanders Road, belongs to the great telling depictions of the shared history of humans and horses, as though advancing, so to speak, from the depth of time, across the brilliant fields of battle where, in the space of a sparkling afternoon, of a charge, of a gallop, kingdoms and the hands of princesses were lost or won. Zeus 23. I had three godfathers, and while two were quite inconspicuous, the third was a man made up entirely of unique qualities, one might even say peculiarities. A dandy and a reactionary, a lawsuit monger and a womanizer, his moods changed as often as the weather, and, as is usual in that part of Westphalia, storm clouds predominated. Most important, at least in our context, was his foolish love of beautiful horses. Thoroughbreds were de rigueur in his stable, stallions above all. However, I also remember a wonderful grey mare named Atalia, which he sold on to the Horse of Orange. It goes without saying that she had a high proportion of Arab blood. The last of his horses that I met personally before our paths parted forever was a dark bay stallion of immaculate purity of Arabian blood. In stature and temperament, he was thoroughly Oriental. He had a family tree that you could trace back with some goodwill to the five favorite mares of Muhammad. It was only in the nomenclature that his owner and the apparently long string of predecessors had opted for a different cultural milieu. Over the entrance to his box, a classical pavilion, a la Carl Friedrich Schinkel, architect, with an interior upholstered in leather like an English gentleman's club, hung a nameplate on which was inscribed Zeus 23, known as Bubby. Like many members of local equestrian clubs, my godfather also joined a mounted troop of the Sturmabteilung, SA, after 1933. It was to his good political contacts that he owed the pleasure of being able to receive Prince August Wilhelm of Prussia, known as Avi, at his summer house. The prince, then Obergruppenführer of the SA, had, since joining the Nazi Party in 1929, member number 24, made himself useful to the party by trawling for votes and new members among the exclusive upper circles of the aristocracy. The same purpose was achieved by the Nazi policy towards equestrian sports in general. As a pseudo-aristocratic honey trap to lure in the upper classes, and the SA cavalry more specifically, even if this was less elitist than the comparable structures of the SS. The more sporty and comradely, one might even say warmer and more welcoming, cavalry of the SA attracted members from the nobility, but also young farmers, and can be seen as a successful tool for the broader integration and diversity of social classes in the new state. Moreover, with instruments like this, the Nazi state managed to bring on side an entire nationwide network of clubs and organizations, together with their officials, equestrian professionals, sportsmen, horse lovers, breeders, and veterinary surgeons. Having developed over centuries, this network encompassed, besides the individuals, a wealth of institutions, associations, clubs, schools, and stud farms, and types of knowledge which were passed on in various ways. Germany had long been a nation of horses, And even if the economic and logistical importance of the horse had already declined sharply by 1930, when the Nazi organizations sought to inherit this culture, the horse was still unique and unrivaled by any other animal in terms of the values, knowledge, and social distinction associated with it. Whoever wanted to win over the German people could not fail at the same time to draw in Germany's horse-loving population, even if the Führer himself did not actually ride or like to be photographed on horseback, unlike Mussolini. See page 245. All political co-riders were welcomed on this hunt, be they the decadent scion of the aristocracy, a champion Olympic athlete, or a reasonably successful writer. As is typical of Germany, the politicization of equestrian sports and horse breeding was achieved primarily through private clubs, and this also explains the, ultimately unsuccessful, attempt by the SA leadership to take them over en bloc. The development of equestrian sports clubs experienced a boost with the successful export of British horse racing to Germany in the early 1820s. There is a reason why Germany's first thoroughbred racing event took place in August 1822 in Bad Doberan, a Mecklenburg spa town. After the lifting of the continental blockade, successful London horse trader and bookmaker Richard Tattersall, the younger, travelled throughout northern Germany and sold the classic flat race, a competitive and spectator event suited to the English thoroughbred, to the horse-breeding landed gentry to the east of the Elbe. The races were intended to serve as a promotional event that would raise the sale price of the horses. Doberan was the prelude to an amazing success story. Racing spread through Germany faster and earlier than any other European country also infected with British racing fever, France, Italy, Russia, taking root along with the associated clubs and racetracks. Berlin, 1829, Wrocław, Breslau, 1833, Hamburg, and Königsberg, 1835, Düsseldorf, 1836. Certain German princes also caught the racing bug, following the example of the Stuarts and Hanoverians, and actively supported horse racing or excelled as breeders. Thus, the Prussian Crown Prince and later King, Friedrich Wilhelm IV, founded a prize for the Berlin race, the Silver Horse. His counterpart in the southwest, William I of Württemberg, set up at the Royal Stud Farm the most significant Arabian breeding program on German soil, and although in the 1830s he already possessed an impressive stud, 4 stallions and 18 broodmares of Arabian descent, along with 2 Nubian and 30 other Oriental mares, he nevertheless sent his equerry Wilhelm von Taubenheim, accompanied by the writer Friedrich Wilhelm Hacklander, to the Orient in 1840 to acquire yet more purebreds. While initially German authors were critical of the goal of breeding specifically for speed, and skeptical about racing as a measure of quality, there were also voices veering over to the other side, such as Count Veltheim of the Duchy of Brunswick, or the Hungarian Count and horse connoisseur Stefan Zecheny, who soon recommended racing as a very useful test for investigating the quality and value of each horse. Since the establishment of the Union Club in 1867, Germany also had its own National Equestrian Federation, which took on a similar function to the Jockey Club, although without restricting its membership to the aristocracy, as the English club did. From the beginning, the Union Club was open to representatives of other social classes. Its exclusivity was regulated by the membership fee alone. The club was a melting pot of bourgeoisie and aristocratic liberalism, which was significant not only for the sport, but also in political and social terms. In the year of its foundation, Otto von Bismarck joined its ranks. He was a keen fan of English racing. The association maintained 2 racecourses in Berlin, Hoppegarten from 1868 and Grunewald from 1909. But the Grunewald racetrack had to make way for the sports facilities of the 1936 Olympics, and was therefore unceremoniously closed in 1933. Blood and speed. All origins are colored by legend. Whatever the historical reality of the mythical 5 mares of Muhammad, the 3 foundation stallions of English thoroughbred stock were not invented. All the same, their story is entwined with myth. This is especially true of the youngest of the three, Godolphin Arabian, named after his last owner, the Earl of Godolphin. He was a diminutive bay stallion, standing at 15 hands, 152 centimeters tall, with a beautiful head and an unusually high croup, reminiscent of a wild horse. His features were captured for posterity by George Stubbs. There remains some doubt about his true provenance, and his arrival in England has the gloss of a Latin lover and good old-fashioned machismo. He came from France, from the dust of the road. The story goes that he was a gift from the Bey of Tunis to Louis XV, but did not find favor with the king, and found himself outside pulling a water cart. There he was discovered in 1728 by a certain Mr. Coke, who in turn sold the stallion to a Mr. Roger Williams, who gave him to the Earl of Godolphin. He languished in the stables like a kind of male Cinderella, with only a cat for company, until the moment of his finest hour. This strange tale caught the attention of the German poet and novelist Achim von Arnim, who marveled at the fact that an Arabian stallion condemned to the life of a cart horse because of his unfavorable appearance should attract the attention of the most beautiful Arabian mare, one who had resisted all advances until then, and that from this partnership should emerge the most ideal progenitors of all thoroughbreds. According to other reports, he allegedly bit and killed the intended sire, a lackluster rival, before leaping upon the beauty named Roxana, who seemed to return his interest, a fervent start to a glittering career as a stud and foundation sire. At the time, when the three desert fathers of the English thoroughbred breed began to work their fertile magic at the turn of the 18th century, the Arabian horse was already a well-known guest in the British Isles. The first representative of this breed is said to have entered the country during the reign of Alexander I of Scotland, 1107 to 1124. Richard the Lionheart, 1189 to 1199, bought horses in Cyprus, while his notoriously penniless brother and successor, John Lackland, enjoyed receiving elegant animals as gifts. After the English Renaissance, an influx of Oriental horses gradually increased. But it was not until the reigns of James I and Charles I that the first imports were made on a grand scale. Their most significant import was that of the Royal Mares, a group of 43 Oriental, Arab, Berber, and Turkish, some of which were in foal and were regarded as the alpha females of English thoroughbred breeding. More distinctly than the individual acquisitions of stallions, amidst favorable circumstances and noteworthy coincidences, this systematic acquisition of Oriental mares was read as a sign of the start of something historic. With them began a breeding policy which was promoted and driven by a European superpower. Spain, for a long time home to the most enduring and intense exchanges between Arab and European culture, was also the country where crossbreeding first took place with Oriental horses from the 8th century. The resulting Andalusian or Genet breeds spread to Italy, especially Naples, and eventually to the entire continent. At the Italian courts of the Renaissance, the possession and exhibition of thoroughbred horses was an integral part of the display of splendor, as described by Jacob Burckhardt. But while these prized horses still resided in the menageries of royal palaces like living jewels alongside rare breed English dogs, leopards, Indian hens, and Syrian long-eared goats, the idea of breeding was developed elsewhere. The experiments carried out at the stud farm at Mantua already had the same goal as those of the English Stuarts at a much later date, namely racing success based on the speed of animals. All interest in and knowledge of the different breeds of horse, says Burckhardt, is as old, no doubt, as riding itself, and the crossing of the European with the Asiatic must have been common from the time of the Crusades. In Italy, a special inducement to perfect the breed was offered by the prizes at the horse races held in every considerable town in the peninsula. In the Mantuan stables were found the infallible winners in these contests. Gonzaga kept stallions and mares from Spain, Ireland, Africa, Thrace, and Cilicia, and for the sake of the last, he cultivated the friendship of the sultans. All possible experiments were here tried in order to produce the most perfect animals. English thoroughbred breeding of the 18th century initially did nothing more than what had been done before them by Arabs and Spaniards, Neapolitans, and Mantuans. They tried, by crossing two good horses, to create a better third. This better copy could be a good cart or workhorse, and indeed such animals also attracted the attention of English breeders. Their main focus, however, was the type of horse whose qualities were proven on the racetrack, or on the battlefield. England has always bred for both types of horse racing, the flat race and the steeplechase. But the five famous British classics, St. Leger, Epsom Derby, Epsom Oaks, 2,000 guineas, and 1,000 guineas for fillies, and other prominent racing events, such as Royal Ascot and the Queen Anne Stakes, remain flat races as they have always been. The secret of success in breeding racehorses was therefore to achieve the perfect correlation of the two parameters for racing, blood and speed. In this context, in the 18th century, the English developed the new market system, which, besides the financial components already mentioned, horse sales, prize money, betting, also included two record-keeping systems. The first of these was the racing calendar, which, following a few sporadic precursors, began to be published regularly from 1727, edited by a certain John Cheney in Arundel. In initially annual, later fortnightly editions, the calendar listed the results and prize money won in recent races and ran announcements of upcoming events. By ranking British racehorses, Cheney codified the aim of thoroughbred breeding, speed. The breeding of thoroughbred horses was consistently subjected to this same goal. The sought-after qualities, build, fitness, health, endurance, character, dominated the agenda of breeder and trainer alike. Characteristics such as form and beauty were inherited qualities. With breeding, another deeper kind of chronology came into play. The sequence of the generations and the results of each cross. Whereas the needs of the racing and betting systems were met by the short-term memory of the racing calendar, which recorded the victories and defeats of the past weeks, months, and possibly years, breeding, on the other hand, needed a longer memory. Breeders needed to be able to record the success or failures of each cross along the long line of the generations. Racehorses needed to prove their qualities not only on the racetrack, but also in the covering yard. This is their second touchstone. Such a record provides a measure not only of their own current form, but that of their descendants. It was for this purpose that the equestrian world acquired its second record-keeping system when the stud book was established at the end of the 18th century. The stud book, first published by James Weatherby in 1791, initially in the form of An Introduction to a General Stud Book, is always characterized as a kind of genealogical peerage of the English thoroughbred. Indeed, it is both surprising and somewhat amusing to note that this English register of the nobility of horses preceded that of the nobility of Englishmen, Burke's peerage, by a good 35 years. Indeed, the equine aristocracy that was the focus of the stud book was a nobility based purely on blood, not on merit or success. One might have conceived of a genealogical archive which listed horses of any origin, regardless of whether they came from the Levant or the British Isles, on the condition that they succeeded either on the racetrack or in breeding successful races. The stud book, however, took a different path, and stipulated that the provenance of all horses entered had to be traceable to one of the three foundation stallions of English thoroughbred stock. In other words, the stud book of English breeding was specifically a stallion book. And yet, at the time of the first edition, towards the end of the 18th century, all breeders and connoisseurs were quite aware that you did not produce a pure thoroughbred by mating an Arab or Oriental stallion with a native mare. The quality of the mother was no less important than that of the father. Mares of Oriental provenance were far superior to locally bred mares when it came to producing an English thoroughbred. And secondly, the main thoroughbred breeding lines, as the stud book revealed, emerged through ongoing pure breeding or inbreeding. This was what gave the English thoroughbred a high enough proportion of Arab blood, 60% and above, and what made these bloodlines sustainable in the long term. It was only by systematic in- and inbreeding, that is, repeated pure breeding, that the well-known agriculturalist Robert Bakewell, 1725 to 1795, was able to succeed in his selective breeding of sheep, cattle, and horses. Charles Darwin, himself from a horse-loving family on his mother's side, the porcelain dynasty of the Wedgwoods, was familiar with the traditional practices of breeders as well as the more experimental approach taken by Bakewell, and referred to both in his On the Origin of Species. Charles Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, the founding father of eugenics, went a step further, and in 1883, acknowledged the contribution of English horse breeders to his research. Their experiments had shown how suitable breeds or bloodlines could be helped to prevail against the less suitable. The English horse breeders had proved what selection, properly applied, could achieve. Targeted tampering with genetic inheritance in order to improve a breed, this was the great dream of the eugenicists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But as they themselves admitted, the birth of this dream came much earlier, in the stables of the 18th century. The eugenicist of racehorses was a contemporary of Galton. He came from Australia, was called Bruce Lowe, and died before he managed to publish his theory. His figure system, as Lowe referred to his numerological approach, was an attempt on the basis of the two record-keeping systems, the racing calendar and the revised general stud book, to develop a combined analysis that would give future buyers and breeders more reliable knowledge. Lowe started from the assumption that all the horses entered in the general stud book could be traced through the maternal line to one of the 43 root mares, which were considered genetically unique and not traceable further back. Lowe organized and ranked the 43 genealogical lines emanating from these mares according to the number of race winners produced on that respective line in the three particularly important races, the Epsom Derby, Epsom Oaks, and St. Leger. Analysis of additional qualities allowed him to split individual lines into running families and sire families, that is, families with a race winner, running, and families who had spawned a winner, sire. With his database, Lowe believed he would be able to forecast successful crosses and produce future race winners in a planned way. Two German competitors, Hermann Guse and J.P. Frenzel, were simultaneously attempting a similar combination of genealogy, statistics, and prognostics, and were later invoked by the numerous critics of Lowe's system. The 20th century saw renewed attempts involving calculations, lists, and tables, the Bobinski tables and the Polish tables, etc., to make the breeding of racing champions predictable. None of these systems would definitely achieve this goal, and indeed, even modern DNA-based genetics cannot, although it can of course explain why none of the precursors succeeded. With genealogy, one of the biggest topics on the internet now, besides sex, one can, without being a prophet, predict a brighter future for the study of equine nobility. The internet is already teeming with bloodline charts listing the most famous English, German, and American races since the 18th century, and their Oriental sires and mares. The anatomy lesson. Young men, sturdy animals. The natural gravitational center of the horse world is the market, the meeting place for everyone whose working life revolves around horses. Experts, breeders, buyers and sellers, honest traders and other less honorable types, grooms, stable boys, coachmen, breakers and handlers. The peripheries of the market teem with assorted peddlers hawking their wares, bridle makers, saddlers, craftsmen and vendors of blankets, grooming combs and whips. Then there are the swarms of customers, farmers, tradesmen, stable masters, carters, employees of the omnibus company, and procurers of remounts for the army. And amidst all these representatives of supply and demand stands the true protagonist of the market, shaking its head, snorting and chewing at the bit, the living commodity, the horse. Cold bloods and draft horses, named after the regions of their provenance, thoroughbreds or hot bloods, in whose veins English blood flows, giant steeds, sturdy pack horses, mounts, carriage horses, ponies, and mules. Colts and fillies, grand specimens and old nags. All colors, shapes, and sizes. Groomed, with flicking tails and braided manes. Some, you'd suspect, would be dragging their hooves. While with others, you could imagine yourself soaring from the word go and trotting back home in the morning sun. The horse market is held in the same location, in the middle of the city, summer and winter, only in summer you can smell it from a lot further away. Paris's horse market was not the biggest in the country. Thousands of horses and even greater armies of visitors, buyers and fanciers flocked to the Foire in Brittany, Poitou or Franche-Comté. But these fairs took place only in spring or summer, once or twice a year, while the Paris market ran all year round, twice a week, on Wednesdays and Saturdays. From 1642, it had a fixed location in Faubourg Saint-Marcel, a stone's throw from the Salpêtrière Hospital. In 1859, it had to make way for Haussmann's construction plans and was relocated to the Port d'Enfer, while in 1878, it returned to the old site for a last quarter of a century. It closed in 1904. The name of the Rue de l'Essai still recalls the track along which the horses were led and shown off by servants and young lads. A catwalk for horses, which was by no means restricted to the haute couture of the Anglo-Arab thoroughbreds. The smart, fashionable district of Faubourg de Roule, north of the Champs-Élysées, was home to the handlers of racehorses and top-end animals. The image of the horse market is dominated by the powerful workhorses who came from the west of the country, the Percherons, mostly grey and dapple grey, sometimes brown, strong animals, which, despite their size, move with elegance and, one might even say, with grace. Like all horse markets, Paris's Marché aux Chevaux was also a meeting hub for men. Women, on the other hand, were restricted to serving in the taverns on the edge of the market, where deals were clinched. There was no place for them at the actual market. Horse trading was men's work. Nobody would have noticed the waif-like boy who hung around the Paris horse market for days on end, in 1851 and the following year. Confident that he was unobserved, he scribbled away on the notepad he took everywhere with him, like a painter on his travels. Nobody recognized him as a young woman dressed as a man, pursuing her ambitious plan. She wanted to create a work such as that begun by the revered Théodore Géricault, but never completed. A huge, broad canvas that did not simply repeat the famous cavalcade of the Parthenon frieze, but updated it, bringing it into the present day, with a new contemporary interpretation. Rosa Bonheur had already made her name as an animal painter, and now she was thinking big. The following year, in 1853, it was finished. The salon where Bonheur displayed her monumental work, the Horse Fair, 5 meters long and half as high, was a triumph. Plate 12. The press and public were thrilled. Delacroix feted it in his diary, and the Emperor and Empress bowed to her artistry. At a stroke, she became a household name. She traveled, roaming the wild Pyrenees and enjoying it, when Spanish smugglers made eyes at her. In the autumn, she returned to Paris, where she had a revelatory experience. Her painting was displayed first at Ghent, then it was hung in her hometown, Bordeaux. Everywhere it evoked unanimous admiration. But no one wanted to buy it, or was in a position to. Her dealer, Ernest Gambart, a big shot in the Victorian art scene, had the painting brought to London. Even 2 generations after Jacques-Louis David and Antoine Genrot, France could boast the best historical and horse painters of the century. Géricault, Delacroix, Vernet, Fromentin, Renault, Meissonier, and now Rosa Bonheur was added to the list. But the truly moneyed clientele were in England. A short while later, the money was all to be found on the east coast of the United States. Gambart had Thomas Landseer, the brother of the famous animal painter Edwin Landseer, produced an engraving of the Horse Fair and organized an exhibition of French art, managing to lure Queen Victoria and Prince Albert to the grand opening. The horse-loving queen had the masterpiece brought over for a private viewing at Windsor Castle. Now it seemed success would be found in England, after all. And yet, as if the picture were simply too big for Europe, it was eventually sold to an American. Was Theodore Géricault familiar with the Greeks? Did he have Phidias and the Parthenon frieze in mind when he worked on his Roman horse race? It remains to be proven either way. Whether he had them in mind or not, he also dreamed of a large format canvas, 9 or 10 meters long. He had allegedly already made a start on such a work when he suddenly left Rome in late September 1817 to return to France. But all that remained, after 7 months of repeatedly interrupted work on Course de Chevaux Libres à Rome, was an abundance of sketches and drawings, now scattered around the museums and private collections of the world, and some oil studies in Paris, Lille, Rouen, Madrid, and Los Angeles, which are among the most perfect works the painter created in his short life. See Plate 13. In 1645, John Evelyn went to sea and described the race of Barbary horses which traditionally took place towards the end of the carnival along Rome's Via del Corso. Over a century later, 1788, Goethe also witnessed this race of riderless and unsaddled, and therefore free, Berber horses. Géricault saw it some 3 decades later, in February 1817. And just as Goethe immediately noted down his impressions, so Géricault began to draw there on the spot. His first drawings, a watercolor study and an oil sketch that followed, breathe the spirit of the street where the race takes place, the suspense and tension among the participants, the speed, the danger, and the attempted safety provisions, cordoned off spectator stands, guards, a trumpeter who will give the start signal any moment now. These are snapshots, instantaneous impressions. Some are so succinct that they come up again and again in later versions, like the detail of a servant boy clinging to a horse's tail, trying to hold it back as it pulls forward. This is not invented. It's something the artist has seen, either on the Corso or somewhere in the Campagna. As the composition develops and the final painting starts to come into focus, the individual elements within it start to take on a life of their own. The painter isolates distinct groups, a horse, 2 men, lifting them out of the original story and turning them into building blocks to be experimented with. He inverts the orientation of the scene. The horses no longer run from right to left, but now head in the opposite direction. He changes his position, and with it his perspective, letting his audience penetrate deep into the action, thereby increasing the dramatic tension. He draws on his academic training, depicting the servants unclothed, in antique nudity. This is how the race might have looked in Imperial Rome. He draws inspiration from the masters, taking from Raphael the image of a fallen man, Heliodorus in the stands, the Raphael rooms in the Vatican, from Michelangelo the profile of a naked young man from the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. His composition gains clarity and simultaneously loses pace, impetuosity. It starts to come too close to Poussin, threatening to become academic in tone, too quiet, too classic, too sublime. The painter corrects himself, steering in the opposite direction. He gives the servants back their colorful trousers and red caps, takes out the fallen man, adds some dramatic spots of light on the horse's flanks, disregarding the rules of how light actually falls. He brings his image back from the realm of an imaginary antiquity. But the present day, where he sets it now, is no longer that of February 1817. It has acquired the form of a timeless present. The contemporariness is in the eye of the beholder. Perhaps Géricault scholar Lorenz Eitner was right when he remarked that the men leading the horse in the Roman carnival looked like a gang of Jacobins acting out of the Parthenon frieze. See Plate 13. Géricault has been called a painter of the street, the first visual poet of the city, and the precursor to Constantin Guise, whom Baudelaire celebrated as a painter of modern life. But while the street gave Géricault his motifs and his impressions, when it came to drafting the eventual painting, it was his study of the masters that gave him his architectural and dramaturgical skills. Things were no different 3 decades later with Rosa Bonheur. She, too, found her motifs on the street and at the marketplace. But when she returned to her studio, she found her role models there waiting for her, and foremost of them was Jericho. She owned a few sketches and prints by him, including a lithograph from the series produced in London in 1820.